Hey, everybody. As you know, immigration is a big topic right now. I think about the city where I live and how discussions about immigration took on a new depth when Boston recently saw an influx in migrants like border towns do. In this theology lab, I talked to Matthew Sorens from World Relief. He co-authored Welcoming the Stranger with Jenny Yang. We talk about why World Relief responded differently than the Episcopalian Church when the Trump administration brought in white South Africans as refugees, and what Matt's thinking on that topic looks like. And most importantly, Matt asks, what difference should being a Christian make for our politics and how we approach immigration right now? Here's the interview with Matthew Sorens. Matt, thank you so much for being a guest on Theology Lab.
Yeah, great to be here.
There are Christians who point, right, to Romans 13 and ideas of obedience, fidelity to authorities. And then there's also the Christian call to radically love those who are facing oppression. So how do you think about these kind of competing claims? I mean, I want to boil it down to this question of, like, should Christians be prioritizing justice or compassion, or?
Yeah, I think it's often a false choice. Honestly, I think we make a mistake whenever we say, well, I'm cutting out this part of the Bible or this part of the Bible because it doesn't suit my politics or my, you know, my preferences of who I think I should be caring about. I think we have to take them both seriously, but also in their context and rightly understood. I mean, I think it's not so much just a question of justice or compassion, because there's a difference sometimes between justice and law. Like, laws can be just, but they also could be unjust. But even that isn't to say that laws are irrelevant. Romans 13 tells us that God establishes government for a good purpose to maintain order. Certainly that includes protecting citizens. And I think we ought to affirm that. Certainly there could be instances, and biblically there are instances, where the law of the state is directly in contradiction to a law that God gives to his people. So you can think of the Hebrew midwives in Exodus not killing little children. You could think of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego not bowing down to an idol. Even there, you could argue, and of course, scholars spend lots of time looking at the different words. Is this submitting to the authorities? Is it being subject to them? Is it obeying them? Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego remained subject to the governing authorities. They didn't start a rebellion against Nebuchadnezzar, but they didn't do what God had commanded them not to do in worshiping an idol. Mm. The good news here is I think that, you know, that presents this question of, well, are we called to civil disobedience when it comes to how we interact with immigrants? That's an interesting question. I don't actually think we have to get there in the United States context most of the time, because, you know, if the question is, should we love and welcome our immigrant neighbors or should we obey the law? I'm pretty sure the answer is yes. And at least for the moment, and this could change, and we should be really mindful of changes in public policy at the federal or the state level that could have very significant religious liberty implications. But generally speaking, that's a false choice. For your church to run an English class and teach English to people, whether you know their legal status or not, is not breaking any law. To share the gospel with someone and baptize them and serve them communion or teach them Sunday school or let them teach Sunday school to you, which might be just as likely, regardless of their legal status in the United States, there's no violation of law there. Where you do get into a black and white legal issue is in terms of employment. Like, if you're paying someone to teach Sunday school, that's where it could be an issue. But in terms of, like, the normal ministries that a church or just an individual American citizen would provide to or interact, ways that they would interact with their immigrant neighbor, regardless of what that neighbor's legal status is, there's not a violation of law there at the federal or at the state level. And again, I think it's important that we guard that as a matter of religious liberty. We don't, certainly for World Relief, we are very concerned about any measure that would have the state telling the church, you're allowed to minister to these people, but not these people. We have governments around the world that do that sort of thing, and it's very troubling. But for the moment, I think it's sort of a false choice of should we obey the law or should we show kindness to our immigrant neighbors, show compassion, share the gospel, receive sometimes the gospel from them as well. I don't think we are actually at the point where we have to make that decision in most situations.
I am grateful that at the moment it's a false choice. Can I ask you, what would have to change? What's something that could potentially change in which, let's just say, Christians would need to take more seriously the possibility of entering into civil disobedience?
Yeah, I mean, again, hypothetically, and those are complex questions. I mean, I will give you a real example. Whether this would have required civil disobedience or not, I'll just say I'm grateful we didn't get to that, but it was where people started to have to think about this. Yeah. In 2005, there was a bill in the House of Representatives that would have made it a felony to knowingly assist someone who was present unlawfully in the country in furtherance of their unlawful status. So the question really comes to what does in furtherance of their unlawful status mean? Yeah. And because that bill passed the House of Representatives but did not pass the U.S. Senate, it never went to a judge, you know, to test that question. But we were concerned at World Relief. You know, we run English classes at a church down the street from my office, and we don't ask people about their legal status. Sometimes, though, the teachers who get to know their students know their students' stories, which includes legal status in some situations. I actually remember at the time, this was almost, you know, this was 20 years ago, but meeting with our member of Congress in the suburban Chicago area who had just voted for the bill and expressing our disappointment, disagreement, and she assured me that she had supported an amendment to make it a misdemeanor instead of a felony. And I guess that's an improvement, but really we don't want our, you know, our ESL teachers having misdemeanors on their record for teaching English either. And again, I think that probably would have been challenged for constitutional reasons, First Amendment reasons, had it gone through, you know, had it become law. I also don't think President Bush would have signed it. Yeah. But we could hit something similar now, and I don't know exactly, you know, even at a state level in Florida a year or so ago, there was a bill that passed one chamber of the legislature in Florida that would have made it a felony to knowingly transport someone within the state of Florida who had entered the country unlawfully. And they framed this as like an anti-trafficking measure. But if you think about it from the perspective of a church, especially if you're a Spanish-speaking church that has lots of folks who probably did enter the country unlawfully within your membership, I mean, it's the van that goes and picks kids up for youth group. It's like churches have vehicles on a fairly regular basis. A lot of churches have vehicles and transport people. Now, thankfully, thanks to a lot of good advocacy, and this was the Catholic bishops in Florida and a lot of evangelical churches as well, they amended that before it passed. So it's now against the law to transport someone into Florida, but not within. They changed one preposition, and that pretty significantly changed the meaning. Still, there's, I think, a little bit of a risk if your church is set going off to a Christian camp in Georgia and then comes back into the state of Florida. Theoretically, there's a legal liability issue there, but it's not the day-to-day reality of like, oh, bringing people to church, or of course, bring, you know, a school bus driver, or like, you know, so many different things beyond the church context that you could think of where this would be a challenge. But I think those are the sort of situations where it could test that question of what is God's call on me to minister to people, and does it conflict with the law of the state? We're really focused at World Relief on preventing those situations from happening, which is why we think it's so important to pay attention to questions of public policy. And for many reasons, out of concern for immigrants themselves, obviously, as well, but also for religious liberty reasons, for the church and for, you know, Christian ministries that want to serve people in faithfulness to the biblical commands.
Welcoming the Stranger, there is a point where you quote a politician saying, hey, I'm not against immigration. What I want is legal immigration, and I want people to wait their turn. So my question for you is it realistic or not to be asking people in the world to be waiting their turn to come and enter into the U.S.?
I mean, I think it is. I think we ought to have processes. I'm not someone who said just, you know, open wide the gates and everyone walks in and we don't know who's who. I think it's really important. This goes to that Romans 13, you know, good purpose of government concern, that our government knows who's coming into the country, has reasonable, you know, criteria for who is allowed in, obviously would want to keep out anyone whose intention was to do harm. That's what we've always said at World Relief. We think we ought to have secure borders. That's not the same thing as a closed border that no one ever crosses, but our government should be monitoring, should be deciding who should be allowed in and for what purposes. Now, I do think that the reasons that people are leaving should be a factor that we consider when we weigh whether they should be allowed in or not. So I think the sort of the ethical weight of someone who is curious what the United States is like and would like to immediately be allowed to come, we may want to let them in. It may be in our interest to let them in. They might spend money in our economy, and it, you know, may be very much in our national interest to let that person come in. But I do think we have a special concern, and I think this is rooted in the scripture as well, for someone who is fleeing persecution. And that's the root of our asylum laws, which have been on the books for many, many years, that basically say if you get to the United States and you can demonstrate with documentary evidence that you have a well-founded fear of persecution on account of specific reasons, your race, your religion, your political opinion, your national origin, your particular social group, you should be allowed to stay. We won't send you back to that situation of danger. There's an Iranian Christian woman who our World Relief Office in Southern California has supported and served, a wonderful woman, converted to Christianity in Iran, which is, you know, anyone probably understands that's like a death sentence. When the government was coming after her, she escaped to the only country that she could travel to with her Iranian passport on short notice, or one of very few, which was Venezuela. Very quickly realized she was not safe there either and made her way up to the United States and sought asylum, and actually won asylum. And this was possible a few years ago. She won her case. She's now lawfully residing in the United States with her family. If she came up today, she would not be given the opportunity to seek asylum. In fact, Iranian Christians in the last few months have been flown to places like Costa Rica or Panama. I guess that's better than sending them back to Iran, but holding them in detention situations, frankly, because we don't know what to do with them, but we're not willing to let them seek asylum in the United States. And that's very troubling to me. It's also quite troubling when you have large, large numbers of people showing up and we're giving them asylum court dates 6-7 years into the future. Like, that's not a good system either. But we really believe at World Relief, we can bring these biblical principles together. We can honor the law, have an orderly system, and treat people with dignity, recognize that everyone is made in the image of God, with a particular concern for those who have fled persecution. And that's what our laws actually say. If we're not going to do that, we should at least change the law by Congress, not just at an executive level. But I think we should keep that commitment. Lots of other countries have made those commitments as well, and for good reasons. Going back to, I mean, a lot of the history of those laws comes from the Holocaust, when the United States and Canada and various other countries around the world had Jewish people fleeing the Nazis, and we said, we're full, or you don't fit into the right quota, we're sending you back. And people were killed in the Holocaust. And that's really the origins of these laws that say, we're going to protect people.
Before this interview, we were at an event together, and someone spoke up, shared their testimony about entering this country illegally. And they said, I entered this country. I broke a law when I entered this country. And they also said, I did it to survive. And in that moment, you just felt the tension of this. Okay, I'm gonna shift gears here quite a bit. I want to go to kind of recent political events. World Relief is one of about 10 organizations that has a special relationship with the State Department for resettling refugees. Recently, the current administration had brought in some white South Africans, Afrikaners. The Episcopalian Church decided that they would suspend their relationship, at least temporarily, with the State Department over this. Now, from an NPR piece, and I'm gonna let you kind of build this out. I get the sense that World Relief took a different approach. I just got a little clip from you in that NPR piece, so I want, one, to allow you to kind of explain your position, World Relief's posture towards this, and then can you give us any kind of more general Christian discernment as you went about this process as World Relief did?
Yeah.
Is there anything else that just Christians as a whole can think about here in terms of what are the costs of engaging? What are the costs of not engaging?
Yeah, no, I think that's exactly the question. I mean, so President Trump signed this executive order going back a couple months, announcing that Afrikaners from South Africa would be given access to the U.S. Refugee Resettlement Program, which, so from our perspective, sort of came out of nowhere. I mean, like, they were not on our radar as a group of people who were, frankly, that are refugees, because legally you're a refugee when you're outside of your country of origin because of well-founded fear of persecution. That's not the group. You know, these people who are still within South Africa. You know, we talked to some of our church partners in different parts of the world, and most church leaders in South Africa are pretty clear that some of the alleged persecution that the United States government is alleging is not really happening. Which isn't to say that there's not violence in South Africa. There absolutely is, and it affects white people and black people and everyone else, and that's a huge problem. It's a huge problem in many parts of the world, but it's severe in South Africa. I don't want to minimize that or that people have been victims of awful crimes. I think I'm personally skeptical of the idea that this is systemic racism towards this white ethnic minority. And it is troubling to me that we would resettle people our government is classifying as refugees from that group while we have closed off refugee resettlement to the rest of the world. Refugee resettlement was suspended in an executive order on January 20th. Now, this is where it gets complicated for us as World Relief. We are, or historically have been, one of 10 refugee resettlement agencies. We've had that designation for, you know, since the 70s. The largest evangelical organization in that category. When we saw this executive order, our initial discussions at our leadership team was, let's look at our mission. Our mission at World Relief is to boldly engage the world's greatest crises in partnership with the church. Is the situation of Afrikaners in South Africa among the world's greatest crises? In our estimation, it's not. It's not to say we're not sympathetic to the individual circumstances that some people may have experienced, but the Democratic Republic of Congo, definitely in the world's greatest crises. The civil war in Sudan, definitely among the world's greatest crises. What's happening in Burma? What's happening in Syria? What's happening in Ukraine? What's happening in Haiti? These are the world's greatest crises, and it's not an accident that many of those are places that World Relief operates. What's happening in Gaza, either directly or through partnerships, we operate internationally in those contexts, and those are historically, many of those are the places that refugees have been resettled to the United States from, often after 10 or 15 or 20 years in a refugee camp. Many of the folks from the DRC, for example, the Democratic Republic of Congo, they didn't flee last week. I mean, they fled years and years ago and have been stuck in awful situations. So honestly, like when we first were aware of this, we presumed that meant that the U.S. State Department would be reopening the refugee resettlement program. And if it was just going to be for Afrikaners, we would not have participated. In fact, we had the press release written to say that. And then the U.S. government was a little craftier than that. They didn't reopen the U.S. Refugee Resettlement Program. They brought people on a charter plane to the United States, and then they made them eligible for a range of services that are funded by the Office of Refugee Resettlement, which is a different part of the federal government within the Health and Department of Health and Human Services. Those funds are still there. We're still serving thousands and thousands of people with those funds. And basically, we had to make the choice, do we opt out of serving thousands of people who we actually think have been vulnerable to the world's greatest crises? Any refugee who's within 5 years of their arrival in the United States qualifies for some of those services, as well as asylees, people who are granted asylum, parolees from Afghanistan and Ukraine, certain other categories of people, Haitian entrants. So for us, it was a very complicated decision of, do we opt out of serving these large number of people who are, we think, actually are very central to our mission because we disagree with the government, or we have questions, at least, about the government's designation of these other individuals. And we decided, you know what, we're going to serve this, at this point, for World Relief. It's been one family with dignity. And, you know, we believe they're made in the image of God the same way that we believe everyone is. We may be skeptical of their claim to refugee status, but ultimately we don't have the authority to make that determination. That's a governmental determination. But I respect the decision the Episcopal Church made in this regard. I also think, frankly, had every resettlement agency made the same decision, there would be tens of thousands of people without access to services, which actually might be exactly what certain people in this administration would prefer to happen, would be to basically shut down the refugee resettlement infrastructure altogether instead of sustaining it so that it could be revived at some point. Even hopefully, we hope in this administration, we continue to advocate with this administration. You know, President Trump talks a lot about wanting to stand with persecuted Christians. Most refugees resettled in the United States last year were Christians, and most of those Christians were actually from the 50 countries where Open Doors says that Christians face the most severe persecution in the world. Mm-hmm. Countries like Afghanistan, like Burma, like Iran, like Iraq, Syria. These, we've already resettled a lot of those folks last year. We want to be able to keep serving them. But also, if he really believes in religious freedom and protecting people who fled religious persecution, not that those are the only people we're concerned about. We're, of course, concerned about Muslims and Hindus and Buddhists and others as well. We think they're all made in the image of God. But at least to be consistent with his own rhetoric, to let those who fled persecution on account of their Christian faith come to the United States. And we're going to keep making that case. I don't know what the administration will decide, but we're advocating as creatively as we can.
Well, I appreciate you kind of naming kind of the layers of depth to the decision making around keeping that relationship with the State Department or not. That adds a lot more that's in that NPR piece. This question has a couple different parts. I want to think a little bit about this, the context that I'm in here, right? Being in a progressive city like Boston, we have seen an influx of migrants. And what I think that has done has kind of shaped perceptions around immigration, probably even created a little more sympathy towards border towns where this is happening at a much higher rate. There's kind of two questions here. I want us to think a little bit about limits. One would be, is the question simply, is there space for these people or not? Or is there another way of thinking about that kind of question for cities that are facing this reality? And then the second one is, can we build on this sympathy, right? Does it adds a helpful complexity where you have a place like Boston that now might be a little more sympathetic and understanding to a border town. It adds this complexity, but then are there still ways where we can move forward and act on this?
Yeah. You know, Boston's experience was very similar to Chicago's near where I live, and World Relief was very involved in responding to a very large number of Venezuelans who arrived in Chicago in the last few years. Again, that's largely stopped now. I would say one dynamic that a lot of people miss is, in my mind, the most significant challenge is not that a lot of migrants showed up. It's that a lot of migrants showed up allowed in by the federal government, but not authorized to work. That's just asking for a disaster. Mm-hmm. Like, you're allowing people in, giving them, you know, limited information on how to pursue an asylum claim, which is a super complicated process that's going to require you to find legal services, find an attorney in most cases. But you're not authorized to work. And you're also not eligible for federal assistance in most cases. So sometimes cities end up spending a large amount of money to, I mean, just figure out what do you do with all these people who are, if they're following the rules, which, like, it was almost a situation where a lot of people were winking and being like, you have to understand, you're supposed to go find a job even though you're not authorized to work, because that's the only way this situation is going to work. And frankly, that's how generations of immigrants in the past have come. Part of the challenge, I think, honestly, with Venezuelans was when people from Central America show up, they all have a cousin somewhere in the United States. And this is obviously a generalization, but, like, there's long histories of immigration and large families. And so you show up and you have a place to live with your relatives, and they tell you how to go work without authorization. Venezuela doesn't have that long history of migration to the United States because it was the wealthiest country in Latin America not that long ago. People didn't want to leave it. Now, unfortunately, because of an awful government, a repressive government that's also wrecked their economy, there are all sorts of people who fled Venezuela over the number of years, and not mostly coming to the United States, mostly in other parts of South America. But as more have come here, they don't necessarily know someone. And so they're almost naively asking, well, what do I do? And no one has an answer for them. Well, you can't work for, like, you can file for work authorization 5 months after you file your asylum application. I've never met, and I've spent a lot of time at the border, someone who came across the border with their asylum application prepared. Like, you need to find an attorney who can help you with that. It's going to be like a thick set of paperwork documenting the persecution that you're alleging to have fled. So I would say that's one dynamic. And there are policy ways to have addressed that. I think the larger question is this system working? I mean, we've supported legislation at World Relief that would say, actually, we should put the capacity to adjudicate asylum requests in a timely fashion, but with due process, with access to legal counsel, at the border, instead of sending people here with a court date 4 years in advance. And not making that a border town's responsibility, but the federal government should build in the infrastructure to actually host people in a humane setting and not a prison, but let them have access to legal counsel, determine, do you actually have a good case for asylum or not? People who don't have good cases for asylum would quickly learn it's not worth making that trip. People who do would much more readily be able to integrate into a community wherever they want to live in the United States, where they've got family or loved ones, or whatever the case may be. It wouldn't be a perfect situation, but it would be so much better than what we have now. And again, there's legislation to do that. The bill in the last Congress, which had both Republican and Democratic co-sponsors, was called the Dignity Act. It also would have had a bunch of new resources to improve border security, about $35 billion. And some of that was actually having that capacity to adjudicate asylum requests at the border, but also infrastructure to make sure people aren't crossing and sneaking into the country unvetted. And it also would have provided a legalization process for the people who've been here 20 or 30 years, which I think actually that's one of the tensions as well. I mean, I go to an immigrant church, and there are certain tensions with immigrants who've been here a long time who've never been eligible for work authorization, who see Venezuelans or Haitians or certain other groups showing up, and it's really difficult for the first year or year and a half, but then they qualify for work authorization while they have this pending asylum claim, and there's certain tensions there. But why do we still not qualify for that? Why is the city spending money on this group of people when they've never done that for us? And I think they're, you know, to be able to acknowledge the people who've been in our community for a long time, sure, have them pay a fine if they violated a law. Most of them would be thrilled to do so. But I think that would go a long way. Now, will you hit? I'm not someone who thinks we should have unlimited immigration. I think you need reasonable levels of immigration. But I think how you get to what a reasonable level is, I think you start with talking to some good economists. Yeah. Like, what are the labor needs of the United States? And that's a dynamic thing. It won't be the same year to year. But frankly, some of that is self-controlling. People don't want to come if the economy is failing. I mean, we did slow immigration dramatically around 2009, 2010, unlawful immigration. Not by some big change in federal policy as much as by a recession. And I don't think that's a great strategy. I'm not suggesting we do that again, but like, people come when there is a job that they can fill. And that is still the case today. We have actually pretty profound labor shortages, especially in certain sectors of the U.S. economy.
Let's close with this question here of things to do. I really appreciate the work that you do with World Relief. And I think that supporting you and this work is something that I would love for viewers to do. So I'll put a link in the show notes, the ways that people can do that. Beyond donating, I'm wondering if you can speak to two things. For anyone who's watching, for everyone who's watching this video, what is something that you would like to see them do? Could you speak to, if you are an individual, or also if you are thinking about doing something within your church community?
Yeah. I mean, definitely giving is important, so I appreciate you plugging that, especially right now. you know, the governmental resources that usually have been part of World Relief Support are significantly reduced, and that's internationally with USAID and in the U.S. But our mission is to boldly engage the world's greatest crises in partnership with the church, and that's both individuals within the church and also churches as institutions. We have all sorts of opportunities to volunteer, and that's still true even if no new refugees are arriving in the United States. The reality is most of our World Relief offices around the country, 3/4 of the people we served last year were not newly arrived refugees. They were either refugees who'd been here for a few years, or those who had humanitarian parole, or maybe who didn't have any legal status, but whom we can support with English language instruction. The major need for volunteers is like friendship, you know, someone who will, whether as a team or individually. And there may not be a World Relief Office near you, but there's lots of local organizations doing really good work, lots of churches that have individual ministries. So I think that's something I would look for. What's already happening in my community? If it's not there, maybe you start it. But probably there's something already happening, an opportunity for people within your church, maybe partnering with an immigrant-led church in your community that, you know, just not necessarily even as like a service opportunity, but just building a relationship, the opportunity to be friends, to recognize that we are brothers and sisters in Christ. And that would be maybe my first place to start. The second place I would say is advocacy. I know that there's sort of a cynicism in a lot of Americans right now that, wow, government's, it's exhausting. I am exhausted. I mean, I confess, like, it is an exhausting season. But I have also seen advocacy work. I have seen, and probably the clearest example of this to me in relatively recent history was 2018. There was this policy of the Trump administration at the time to separate children from their parents at the border as part of the zero tolerance policy. And it was not popular. It was not popular with Americans as a whole. It wasn't popular with Democrats. It wasn't popular with most Republicans, and it wasn't popular with most evangelical Christians. We had polling at the time that showed that. There was a visceral reaction to children being ripped apart from their parents. You had very conservative evangelical leaders who were very supportive of President Trump saying, we don't like this one. This is not a good policy. I was on Capitol Hill on June 18th, 2018, maybe June 19th, for a World Refugee Day event. We had a bunch of pastors there. And I remember every office I was in, the phones were like ringing off the hook. And I could only hear one side of the conversation, but it was the nice college student intern saying like, oh no, my boss is definitely against separating children from their mothers. Now, this was not even Congress's policy. They hadn't changed a law that put this into effect. It was really the White House's policy. But clearly, especially on one side of the aisle, they were calling down the street to the White House and saying like, this is harming us politically. This is not actually popular with our primary voters. And the president was saying one day that this is just what we have to do. We have to be tough. And a few days later, in fact, I flew from D.C. to El Paso. I was standing at the border when I got the word that the president had signed an executive order changing that policy. And not that it completely stopped all family separation, whether under that administration or others, but this underlying policy that was separating large numbers of small children from their parents stopped. And it was because people made phone calls. And I hate to say it, if people are like under the age of 40, they don't make phone calls. They want to like, but what you mean is I could like send a text somewhere, right? Actually, you probably have to make a phone call. That's how Congress works. And we've got tools to do that at the World Relief website. We have made it as easy as possible. You don't even have to make the phone call. You have to give us your phone number and we'll call you and tell you what to say. You can say whatever you want, but give you some suggestions and it'll connect you to your member of the House of Representatives, your two U.S. Senator's offices.
That has me thinking about, I think it's a group you're going to be speaking to later, Open Door Immigration Services, OTIS, they're on the North Shore of Boston. And I saw this group come into being and it's just a few people who cared and said, how can we help people? How can we go through training and help people to immigrate legally? It's difficult and hard, but it was just a few people who really cared about this. And I look at what it is now and it's beautiful. I'll put a link to it in the show notes if folks want to see an example.
It's so beautiful. And we have, you know, other examples around the country of churches that have done that. Our World Relief offices do similar services. It's still not enough. But it is in that community, it's meeting a profound need where, you know, that's the North Shore of Boston. It was quite a long, I drove that this morning. It's quite a long time to get to where there are maybe legal service providers who are also overwhelmed in the city of Boston and any like major metro area, particularly in the last few years. Legal services are maxed out. There's just not enough. And it's an incredible, profound need. All the more so now as we see like ramped up discussions around deportations and those sort of things, which are impacting, there's this idea that this is impacting people who have committed violent crimes. That may be true in some cases. And frankly, I'm not very sympathetic. If you committed a violent crime, if you killed someone or you raped someone, like I want that person to be deported. I think most Americans agree with that. Like you've lost that privilege. But what I think sometimes gets missed is that the vast majority of people who are vulnerable to deportation have not committed violent crimes. In fact, they've not committed crimes at all. Mm. Some have have crossed the border unlawfully, maybe half or so, a little bit less than half most likely, because you also have visa overstayers and those who are entirely lawfully in a temporary status that can be withdrawn, and then they're vulnerable to deportation. What we've said for a long time, this kind of goes back to that Romans 13 question, like how do you honor the law while also keeping families together, showing compassion? You know, if somebody overstayed their visa or crossed the border unlawfully 20 years ago, what if there was a means to make things right with the government by paying a fine? That's a form of restitution for having violated a law. And presuming they haven't then, you know, committed serious crimes beyond that, they'd be able to stay lawfully and earn permanent legal status. And that's not actually like a innovative idea. This is like what George W. Bush supported. It's what Barack Obama supported. There are members of Congress in both parties that support that today. I would say it doesn't seem super likely in the current political environment, but we still think that's the right balance of, yes, let's honor the law. Let's affirm that the government has an important role that God has given them. And also, let's treat people humanely, keep families together whenever possible, because we believe God actually established the family unit before he ever established government. And also recognize the blessing that immigrants, with and without legal status, have been to this country on an economic level, revitalizing the church in many ways, and in so many other ways as well.
Matt, I want to thank you so much for being a guest at Theology Lab for an in-person interview. Grateful to have you.
Yeah, glad to be here.